Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are here. We are ready to talk about stuff. There's a lot of stuff to talk about, so we'll get started. Let me remind you, may I remind you, that you can write to us, panel at WAMC.org. You can join us by emailing, simple, panel at WAMC.org. And we would love to hear from you. We've been getting a lot of letters over the last couple of days because these are very important topics that we are discussing. They are often distressing. So we people want to know things and they want to get things off their chest. And that's why we're here. Panel at WAMC.org. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe. I'm happy to be invited to the party. Thank you very much.
You can't have a party without you. You always bring the lampshade. We're ready.
You make a point.
The lampshade or the shade?
Yeah. Good point. All right. Look, Terry Gibson is on the phone. He is lecturer and adjunct professor of communications for SUNY New Paltz and RPI, soon to be doing a course with our very own Jim Hendler at RPI, which is very exciting. So, Terry, good morning. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Yes, thanks for having me. Thanks for the little promo for our new class. We're very excited about that. I was just talking to Jim yesterday about that. And we're also looking forward to working with Rosemary this summer.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, the connections that are made on this program are just, it is, you know, all you kids are graduating right now. Just remember, it's all who you know.
We should give out diplomas.
Yeah, that's right. That's Terry. Cohoa City Director of Operations, Teresa Bourgeois, is here. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing fabulous on this beautiful day. I made that up, of course. The news is all bad, but I'm trying to be happy. But I am working with Jim Hendler, too, but I wasn't invited to this other party that sounds fantastic.
The teaching party?
Yeah, the teaching party sounds superb. I'm working with him on a floating solar project, which he and his colleague John Erickson have been fantastic in what they call the Idea Lab, data analytics on our floating solar project, which is so much fun.
But what is it?
What's the project?
Yeah.
So our floating solar is on a human-made, man-made water reservoir.
Oh, I see.
And there's a report that came out in 2018 that says there are 24,000 of these all around the country. And if the U.S. tap that potential by putting floating solar on these 24,000 human-made water reservoirs, you could generate 10% of the nation's energy needs with clean energy.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Right. And so what we wanted to do is figure out, okay, where are they? So they've helped us map them and then overlay economic data. And so you could figure if you want to prioritize disadvantaged communities, because that's one of the things that they've said at the federal and state level, we want to prioritize disadvantaged communities. It basically provides a roadmap. It doesn't. Basically, it provides a visual roadmap of how to prioritize those.
Sounds like a GO to me. Grant opportunity.
It is. Well, we just got a grant from the National Grid Foundation, and a portion of that grid is to fund expansion of this and to look at other kinds of research around it.
Wow.
So, but thank you to Jim Hendler and the amazing Idea Lab.
So, in other words, Jim is the vortex to everything. I'm glad to know that. Rosemary Armeo joins us again. We are thrilled. She is an investigative journalist. Our dear friend, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm glorying in school board elections across the area that resulted mostly in the so-called parental control. Read that, MAGA crazies. Did not make it onto school boards. Very happy.
I have to say, in the elections that I was watching and caring about, I was happy.
Yeah, North and South Colony escaped the scourge. Schenectady and Duanesburg, not so lucky. But the solution, as I've been writing about on Facebook, and Libby's group, Capital Women, is also keeping an eye now on school boards, is we got to go to those meetings. Journalists are not doing it anymore. They're so depleted in numbers, they're not going, they're not watching, so we have to go there. Watch what they do, protest if you don't like it, stand up for what you do think is right.
When you look at the results, can it give you any sort of look into races down, you know,
down the road. Well, it was interesting. The turnout was higher in school board elections than the area has seen before. That was noted in the newspaper today. Mm. So people do care when there's an issue. And I have to say, I myself was thinking, I'm not going to bother to go vote. It's a pain in the neck, nothing I care about. And then I found out about this rather down low effort by first-time candidates, overwhelmingly, never run before. I myself thought about running for the board, but didn't think I had enough time, face time, you know, actually attending meetings and getting involved. That seemed to be no barrier to them. It was like, oh, no, we know nothing? Oh, let's run. And so they did, and there was not a lot of coverage. As I say, I'm really disappointed in all the talk we do on the Media Project about local news coverage. I think we really failed people this
time. You know, you're so right, because it was very hard to find position papers. The candidates certainly weren't
right. They were not advertising their Trumpiness. And those of us, Libby is one, I was another who used social media, were immediately slammed by some of the candidates and their supporters. They're accused of character assassination, of libel, L-I-A-B-E-L. I love that. And slander, and it just isn't true. You know, I mean, if educated people who care about schools and diversity and inclusion have got to stand up. Voting is part of it, and I was really gratified by the voter turnout, but also being aware and staying on top of things.
And I think the voter turnout in these, you know, hyperlocal, particularly school board elections, is so low that if you really decide you want to engage and put some energy into it, you can really have a significant
impact.
Yeah. Because it really is all about, it sounds trite, but who gets their people to go to the polls that day. And I think that the Republicans and the far right in particular figured that out a long time ago. They've been working it, but it can be worked on all sides. And you can have a little bit of energy gives a high impact on those kinds of races.
So let's talk about the big primary races yesterday, mm-hmm. and what we saw. A mixed bag from many perspectives. We are still awaiting results in the state of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth, the Keystone State. Dave McCormick and Dr. Oz, Mehmet Oz, are basically tied by, I think, 800 votes or something like that. They've been going back and forth. Dave McCormick had been leading almost all night, and then as results came in, my understanding primarily from some of the central part of the state really led to I take that back. Actually, Dave McCormick was winning in the west, in the central sections, where Dr. Oz was doing much better in the areas of the eastern part of the state, not the suburbs of Philadelphia, but sort of the Republican environs around the city of Philadelphia. So that is interesting.
It is interesting in that when Trump puts his finger up into the air and sees which way the wind is blowing, I believe he endorsed Oz. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. And so therefore, he may have misjudged.
I think he gambled. I don't think win or lose, he made a bad decision. He believes in celebrity. If he won, if Oz pulls it off, he gets a big, you know, boasting right. And if he loses, he's lost some other ones. He did win others last night, so he's going to claim victory no matter what.
Well, I would, at great risk, I would disagree with you, mm-hmm. And suggest that if, in fact, Oz loses, it's a big loss for him and whatever.
He'll just point to J.D. Vance.
Yeah, know. But he was very tepid, and he sort of said nice things about, like, the way Trump is endorsing now is that it's not I endorse you and you put the scepter, anoint them on each shoulder. He's not really doing that. He'll say an occasional nice thing, and then you can interpret it, so then he'll come back and say, well, I gave my endorsement to this person. Mastriano is a good example of that.
Scary,
I mean,
guy.
He's a very scary guy. Won the race 44% to 20% in the Pennsylvania governor's race. But that endorsement from Trump was very tepid. It was very last minute. And it came in, but he did win. And boy, I was watching his acceptance speech last night, and that was... That's scary.
He's a full-blown big lie believer. But, you know, in Pennsylvania, Trump could not really...
He was at January 6th.
Yeah, he was there. Trump can't really lose in Pennsylvania. All the Republicans were Trumpy to some degree. It was like they were vying for, I love Trump. Oh, I love him more. No, I love him more than you. How could he lose? He can claim victory over anybody.
I don't know. I think that this framing this all about Trump, not Trump, is just not... I listened to Mastriano, too, which I thought was a fascinating. And one of the things he did say is basically, we were going to win anyway. Nice that Trump endorsed me, right? But he made it clear to say publicly. But the thing that I found most astounding in what in the various things he said, because he's clearly a January 6th guy. He said he didn't go to the Capitol, but he was there that day. Mm-hmm. But he's been supporting the big lie. And then he quotes... John Adams, facts are stubborn things. Ugh. So this is a guy who clearly doesn't pay attention to facts and then goes and talks about in his acceptance speech, facts are stubborn things. I looked at the whole quote. It's facts are stubborn things, and whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence. Well, that certainly is the antithesis of his actions, of his focus. And what I worry about is the Democrats really, I think, were quietly cheering him on because they think that they can beat him.
That's a close race. Fetterman, his health is an issue.
Yep.
He had a stroke just last week. He's a quirky guy, and he may appeal to many people. I think he's pretty appealing, but he can turn you off as well as,
Does the stroke hurt him?
Of course. You know, everybody
wants
to help
candidate.
But Fetterman is... Okay, go ahead. No, I mean, I just want to, if I can, I think I have this right. But you were talking about Mastriano?
Yes.
That's governor.
Yeah. And Fetterman's the governor now.
Fetterman's running for
Senate.
Correct.
And he's running for Senate.
Right.
So, I mean, he's running for Senate. If Fetterman was the Democratic primary winner in the Senate race yesterday.
Yes, that's correct.
So he'll be running against either Oz or McCormick.
Sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, the Democratic candidate for governor is the Attorney General, Josh Shapiro.
Right.
That's who the Mastriano crazy man will be running against.
And who's very strong and moderate, right? He's strong across the state. He's well-liked across the state, as I understand it.
Yes.
And couldn't come out last night to speak because he has COVID. But I don't know a lot about him, but what I read is that he is very, very well received, and that there are some Republicans so concerned about Mastriano that they may come over and support him because he is moderate. And this race is very, very critical because the governor appoints the Secretary of State. And so in advance of the next presidential election, the question of who is the governor in Pennsylvania, a key swing state in a presidential race, will be critical. Mm. So if this hyper ultra conservative, he was a full on stop the steal, I believe Trump won guy.
Which is why I think it's interesting that you say you would not frame the race results in terms of Trump. This is all about Trump's control over the party. I think that has to do with who he picks, who he backs, how he claims victory or deals with loss when his candidates don't win. He's solidifying control over the party mechanism, and he sees how he controls elections through these people.
See, I think Trump is a piece of a bigger thing. I think we keep talking about Trump, but I think the bigger issue, and I wonder how much money Peter, if he had any money in this race. I think the influence of Fox News, the influence of that far right funding, and I think Trump is a symptom, not a driver of that. Because if you look at what happened in the J.D. Vance race, J.D. Vance won because Peter Thiel put $15 million into the race because, by all accounts, his PAC essentially became the infrastructure of J.D. Vance's race. And he and Tucker Carlson quietly orchestrated the kumbaya moment between Vance and Trump. And so that was all orchestrated, not by Trump, but by Tucker Carlson and by Peter Thiel.
I think we're probably talking semantics then, Teresa, because Trump has always been the instrument. He didn't engineer the Supreme Court supermajority. He was the instrument of the Heritage Society, and he used it to get what he wanted. And
well,
that's exactly what's happening
now. Or did Mercer's money into the Heritage Society use Trump to get what they wanted? I think this is what I don't mean to be too conspiratorial here, but I think we have to have a broader understanding of what's driving this and what's driving the dialogue in the country. And this gets to the Buffalo story, which I, you know, we'll get to, of course,
right,
because there's a, you know, this the campaigning is on division and on hate, and Fox News has found that to be very lucrative, and some people drive it for philosophical reasons, but it's a real factor in this country, and I think Trump is a, you know, a symptom of it.
Yeah, but don't worry, Chuck Schumer wrote a stern letter to Fox saying do something about Tucker.
But read the New York Times analysis of Tucker Carlson, and that's, you know, he is, you know, that's backed by, he's there because it's lucrative for Rupert Murdoch. You know, but just as I always said, what's Mercer's agenda? You know, what's Peter Thiel's agenda? His money comes from PayPal and Facebook, understands how to drive communication in this country, and they're fomenting this, you know, division.
Yeah. Terry, got about a minute. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just you know, my take from what's happening in the primaries and what happened last night is that there's still a lot of opportunities for any candidate, both an incumbent or someone who just decides they want to run for office, that believes in what we now think of as Trumpism, that believes in promoting all the various lies and conspiracy theories. Unfortunately, these results show that there is still a lot of opportunity for these types of candidates to win. Not always, but still a lot. And it does mean that whether Trump himself still has power or whether the dynamics that he has embraced that have really become ingrained in our society have become somewhat permanent, I think. They've really become permanent. We are permanently divided, it seems. And I think we are a long way from seeing the end of people like Mastriano and others.
We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We're talking about primary results from last night, as well as school board elections across our region. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Teresa Bourgeois, and Terry Gibson making up the panel. Terry, I had to cut you off before we went to break. I will please finish your thought.
I think I finished it, but I just want to say of those races, I did just want to point out that I think it's just very interesting what happened between John Fetterman and Connor Lamb in the state of North Carolina. You had a very traditional politician in Connor Lamb running for office and an extremely untraditional candidate in John Fetterman running for office. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how John Fetterman continues to move his campaign forward. We studied him extensively in my political communication class, and my students loved him. One of the things that we noticed is that, you know, he tends to go to campaign events wearing gym shorts and a hoodie. And he even went to one where President Biden spoke and sat in the front row right by Connor Lamb, dressed in a nice blue suit with John Fetterman and gym shorts and a hoodie, looking right at President Biden. And this is the type of individual that is really shattering all traditional ways of running for office, and it's just going to be real interesting to see how he does.
Well, we will see.
Okay, wait. Why do you think the clothes are important? If he were a woman, we'd be yelling at you, scolding you for noting what he wears. Why is clothing a statement?
Should you wear a hoodie when the president's coming to town?
Well, you can debate whether you should or you shouldn't, but the way that a candidate dresses is part of the way they communicate. Appearance is a big part of communication. It's a nonverbal form of communication. So we can debate what the right dress is, but he is clearly presenting himself in a very unique manner that really shatters all standards of tradition. And it seems to be working for him so far.
Okay, so why do I like it in him and I hate it when Jim Jordan doesn't wear a jacket in Congress?
Because appearance isn't everything. So what is one form of communication?
Why do your students like him? What are they? What attracts them?
Well, they just think that they like his edginess. They like the fact that he's willing to really go against the traditional system. They like the fact that he's got tattoos all over him, and they like the way he talks and carries himself. And they just see him as a real person. They see him as a real, sincere person. My take on this current generation of students that I've been teaching is that they're just extremely skeptical of the political establishment, regardless of party. And they really do seem to appreciate that honest, sincere approach. And they find him very appealing.
I know this is getting off the subject, but if your student said, "Hey, Professor Gibson, I have a job interview at Spectrum Television. What should I wear?" What would you tell them?
I would tell them to analyze their audience, do the research, and try to figure out who they're going to be interviewing with, understand the way the company operates, the company policies, try to research how people at that company dress, and go dress like that. That's what I would tell them. And we do talk about that extensively in our communication courses.
What if they only had, you know, like 18 hours to make the decision?
Yeah,
I just tell them about research.
Tell them to wear a suit.
Right. I mean, I
would.
You know, I would.
I'm kind of motherly.
I would.
Yeah, wear a suit. Or not even.
You're going dress
like, hat. Like maybe not a tie, throw on a jacket, clean the pants. You know, be presentable.
Because it's a sign of respect.
But what if it were a woman who was asking you that question?
Pantsuit. Wear a pantsuit.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
You know,
it's a sign of respect.
But you also want the individuals to take responsibility for the way that they're communicating themselves. And if you tell them what to do, you've kind of taken that power away from them. I really encourage them to do their own research, even if they only have 18 hours. That's plenty of time to do the research. Part of the research is asking for advice from other people like me and others.
Yep.
And I will certainly give them advice similar to what you just gave them. But it is an important choice.
Not to cause too much of a problem here, but I did see when you were speaking that Teresa put her hands over her eyes. Is there a reason, Teresa, that you had great objection to that?
Well, this actually
That's why the panel, you know, is good, because you can mix it up a bit.
Well, this actually is an issue that I've had for a while, with particularly with high school kids and summer jobs and such, that I think each of these are teachable moments. And if you... I have a thing about when you kids sign up for summer jobs, often it's maybe a teacher, a youth worker, somebody who just brings to City Hall or whatever they are, to the school, wherever they're doing the hiring, and says, "Here's a list of kids." And I think that those young people should have to go in, sit down, fill out by themselves an application. They need to dress properly. They need to go through an interview, because I think a lot of people haven't had that experience. And so you should have the experience of going through the process, so that you understand, you know, what, even if it's an interview to go and cut the grass or work in the park or something, you should still get prepared, sit down, do it yourself.
I would just like to note for the record, for the 6, 7, maybe even 8 years that Terry Gibson has been a part of this panel, every time he comes to the studio, he's wearing a sport jacket.
There you go.
So I just want to put that out there, too.
But I just find that people
We all have
and
our,
it's and we all, it's radio.
We all have our own unique style, I suppose. But to make Teresa feel better, I do want to say that at least in my course, in one of my courses, we do a section on interviewing, and the students are required to participate in a mock interview. And they are prepared, they are required to come dressed appropriately for the interview, and they are graded on that. And we also, in one of my courses, in fact, the one at RPI, they do a project where they do make a presentation, and they have to get very dressed up. They have to find, the women have to find appropriate, you know, business wear, and the men have to find a jacket and a tie. And they always fight us on this. You know, well, where am I going to find a tie? Where am I going to find a jacket? But
which they make a point. It's getting harder to find a tie, I must say.
I worked at RPI for 11 years, and I think this is sort of, it's grounded in the time I worked in Boston with young people, and then RPI, where kids could, some of our interns would say, "They told me I have to dress up. Why do I have to do that? I know the stuff. Why do I have to dress up?"
I went into journalism, so I didn't have to dress up.
In any case, back to, can we go back to Terry? What do you think about the best? Is it McCormick would be the best in the race? Have you thought about that, or the differences? What the difference would be?
We are talking about the U.S. Senate Republican primary of Mehmet Oz, Dave McCormick, or Kathy Barnett, who was really, I'll say, problematic on many issues, and yet still got 325,000 votes.
She was surging, but didn't come
24%.
Far. Well, she may have kept Oz from beating McCormick if he prevails.
Yes.
Because she, yeah. Oz and Barnett are pulling from the same group. And so she may be the person who kept, if in fact the trends,
McCormick wins
because the people who do the analysis suggest that probably the pending votes to be counted are more likely his than Oz's. But
what was your question for Terry? I'm sorry.
That is in the Fetterman race, Fetterman McCormick or Fetterman Oz? I mean, I think that they would be two very different races.
I think that, first of all, it's important, I think, to clarify that whether you have Dave McCormick or Dr. Oz, you're essentially getting the same politics. You're getting the same policies. They both embrace the same type of Trumpism policies. So there's no difference there. It's really just in the way they present themselves. And I think Dave McCormick presents himself as a more traditional politician, can come across as being more reasonable, maybe even possibly more moderate, but he really isn't. I think Dr. Oz's celebrity is going to always force him to be more outgoing and slightly more outlandish. And I would think that Dave McCormick is probably going to pull this out, is what my guess is. In terms of running against John Fetterman, I would think that Dr. Oz and the John Fetterman race would be more competitive because both are unique and non-traditional in their own ways. And I think it would be really interesting to see how that plays out. I think if it's Dave McCormick and John Fetterman, I think it's a more stark contrast, and you have a more mainline individual kind of traditional candidate running against someone who clearly likes to present himself in a different way. And this is what I meant about watching John Fetterman, because I'm curious to see if he does run against Dave McCormick, for instance, does he change his candidate image? Does he start wearing a suit and tie more often? Does he start presenting himself as more traditional? Or does he go even further in terms of really breaking the barriers? So it's going to be an interesting race to watch.
Well, I certainly think McCormick brings a whole different set of experience to the, the Senate than Oz does. I mean, McCormick, as conservative as he is, he does...
A former hedge fund executive.
Right, has a military
yeah.
background, and he has government background.
Yep.
So Oz has no government background, and he is,
snake oil salesman.
There you go.
He's a huckster, and that's someone who can get votes and win over. Con men do very well in our political system. It's a set of horrible candidates. Pennsylvania needs to really find better people to run altogether.
And to live there.
Yeah, really, maybe. I don't know. Okay, can we talk about North Carolina?
I absolutely want to. We'd have to take a break. So do you mind? So we'll use it as a tease. When we come back, we'll talk about Madison Cawthorn and North Carolina. Rosemary has stuff to get off her chest, so we'll get to that in just moments right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Teresa Bourgeois, and Terry Gibson. Chuck Edwards, a three-term state senator and business owner, edged out Representative Madison Cawthorn in the Republican primary for a House seat representing North Carolina's 11th district. Luke Ball, a representative for Mr. Cawthorn, said late Tuesday that the congressman had called Mr. Edwards to concede. Mr. Edwards's narrow triumph was called by the Associated Press. The outcome served as a rebuke of Mr. Cawthorn, a right-wing firebrand and the youngest freshman in Congress, who was once seen as a rising star of the Republican Party. Then what happened? It is also a significant victory for the old guard Republicans in North Carolina and Washington, who in recent months had been feuding with Mr. Cawthorn over his personal and political errors and frequent foibles. Mr. Cawthorn, who has used a wheelchair since a car crash that almost took his life at 18, struggled to overcome a series of old and new personal and political errors. He previously faced accusations that he had lied about key parts of his background and that he had been sexually and verbally aggressive toward women. In recent months, he had also been accused of engaging in insider trading, charged with driving with a revoked license, stopped for trying to bring a gun through airport security 3 times.
Yep.
Photos and videos of him partying and emulating sexual antics circulated once while wearing lingerie. In March, he said on a conservative YouTube channel that people he admired in Washington had invited him to orgies and used cocaine. Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the House Minority Leader, told reporters he had spoken with Mr. Cawthorn and told him that he had lost trust in him.
I'd like to be happier about his loss. It certainly is a good thing that he's at least out for now. Mm-hmm. But A, it was way too close.
Way too close.
It's just like Roy Blunt, you know, who was diddling little girls. Right. And he's ousted. It was no great victory because he almost squeaked through. Same here. And the second thing is he crossed the line, which was not lying or deceit or undermining democracy. It was speaking bad about other Republicans. He got more punished than Liz Cheney. He was punished in a way Liz Cheney also was, ostracized from the party. And I'd like to say, oh, wow, he lost, so look out, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar and Matt Gaetz. But I don't see it that way. I think it was just he went a step too far, and even Trump's little, oh, let's give him a second chance wasn't enough to pull him back. No great joy in victory.
I mean, and you're right. It was repeated scandals and blunders, but a lot of Republicans who won or who have been winning have had repeated blunders and scandals.
But a much more serious sort.
And this was going against the party,
right,
and the old guard in both Washington and North Carolina, and they weren't going to stand for it.
And again, it's important to note that the person that beat him, State Senator Chuck Edwards, is still very much a very vocal Trump supporter, very conservative, extremely conservative, and is going to continue to promote the same policies that Madison Hawthorne promoted. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to change the dynamics at all.
Yeah, you're just like a ugly person to, you know, get it. I enjoy the punishment.
I'm sorry, you have to explain that.
That's profound.
He's a despicable person. He demeaned his office. He lied so much even about what happened in the accident that left him. I mean, whatever it was, he's certainly been punished enough. I don't need anything more about it. But he's just deceitful in every way, the epitome of what we don't want in politics right now. So, yeah, I'm very happy that he lost.
I was listening to a reporter from North Carolina. I think it was from North Carolina. Who's very familiar with the district. Said that he did very little constituent service.
He did little to no constituent services. Yes.
Right. So he didn't do the basics of. I was reminded in reading a Politico story. I think it's really important what you said, Rosemary, about what the line was that the Republicans were concerned that he crossed, and that was allegations of cocaine use and attendance at orgies by fellow Republicans.
On them.
Which House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy described as, quote, not becoming of a congressman. So you can, you know, support the, which I agree with him in this case, but it's okay with McCarthy if you are a supporter of the January 6th activities.
Or you stand up for a principle and vote for impeachment,
which
is what Liz Cheney did.
Right. But
and she was booted out.
Right.
And he himself then went on to lie about his thoughts after January 6th and how they transformed. It's just unbelievable that this is the person standing in judgment of the behavior of other congressmen.
So I have no idea how we got here. I mean,
to our country in this way.
That's right.
That's what all I could think of last night. I was watching Fox News. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Not at all, please.
How did we get here, Alan? What is your thoughts? I could think of last night watching the Fox News coverage is, how did our country get to this point?
Yeah, no, I think my thoughts are we're in trouble.
How sometimes you read a book and you say, I don't like any of these people?
Yes.
I'm reading that book right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Washington Post did have an interesting statistic related to Madison Hawthorne's loss, which was that he did best in districts where most people did not have a bachelor's degree. Most people did not have a college degree. He did worse in districts where people mostly had degrees. So,
but you bring that up, and people are going to point out, Terry, that you are an elite academic liberal.
Well,
damn,
I'm just sharing
a basket
the
full
being
of
reported.
Deplorables.
I'm just sharing. I'm just sharing the statistics that are being reported here. I'm not necessarily commenting on what that means, except that.
Well,
what's driving
us?
You are.
Of course you are.
You are so
educated. People didn't vote for the guy who.
But Peter Thiel's an educated person, right? These people. Rupert Murdoch is an educated person.
Peter Thiel.
Tucker Carlson is an educated person. And they're driving
Elise Stefanik.
Is an educated person.
Okay,
Ted Cruz.
But I think
it's not a guarantee.
Right. Okay, but so, I think we're taking what Terry said. And Terry, I'm
yes.
not to be, I don't want to speak for you, but I think Terry's point is different than, yes, there are very smart people who are doing these things and are very right-wing and a little wacky in some ways. However, we're talking about, especially in the Cawthorn case, of who's supporting him, of who that voice is resonating from, not the smarts of the candidate himself.
No, but
we love the poorly educated.
I want to get back.
That?
Yeah,
yeah, no, but that's what I mean. I mean, that's different than yes. Elise Stefanik is a graduate of Harvard. Got it. But the people who are supporting her are not.
But what is she using her megaphone to do? What is the environment? Not to have a discussion. You know, I think it gets back to, I think it's so important now. And the question is, how did we get here? And where are we? These are not fights over policy. These are not policy disagreements. These are fundamental, you know, like fomenting this otherism, right?
Yeah.
And just the fact that these people who are in leadership, who are highly educated, are peddling false information for the purpose of dividing the country and trying to tamp down the vote in some cases. And we can, you know, you can go and say, well, it's a poorly. It's what's driving the discussion. Who's leading the discussion? I'm talking
about. Now, this is
the
mechanism. You have really highly educated and manipulative to people who, for purposes of enriching themselves and gaining power, are manipulating those who do not have the critical thinking skills or the attention to pay attention to how they're being used. That's exactly what's happening. It is part of what's
happening. Well, and they like the message they're hearing.
This is how we got here.
Misinformation, and it's dangerous.
Well, how did we get there, Rosemary? That's a profound point.
Yeah, I think that's how we got here. This year,
to me, I keep looking at the Civil War and what came after. It, you know, that there were two classes, but I think it's more than that. Actually, the more I think about it, the more I think it's we, they, and I'm not sure what that, how that happened.
It's fomenting.
Joe,
division.
I just want to.
Yeah, go ahead, Terry.
Well, just back on this education front. Just one of the ways to look at the statistics that came out of the race related to who has a degree and who doesn't and how they voted. Is that you're talking about a Republican primary where you have only Republicans voting in the primary and you have two Republican candidates. Both candidates promote Trump conspiracy theories. Both candidates embrace Trump policies. They're almost identical in that capacity. So you have a situation where the most educated voters that are Republicans that vote in this race, they chose to vote against Madison Hawthorne. And you have Republicans who have the least amount of education chose to vote for Madison Hawthorne. So, I mean, that to me, that's the way you look at it, is that educated individuals are still very capable in this country of voting for candidates that embrace lies, that embrace white supremacy. So having an education, as we've seen over and over again, does not necessarily influence you voting in a world that's based on reality.
But Terry, every election is a choice. If the educated people are given two conspiratorialists and they pick the conspiratorialist who is also not morally bankrupt, that's a conscious decision. They had no other choice. It would have been better to have a better candidate, but they're not involved enough in the political process, which I think is a problem at every level of our government.
Yes, I would completely agree.
So let's go to some letters, and then we'll take a break at the top of the hour. And I want to hear from, if you would like to write to us, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Lee says, my school board election site ran out of ballots. The turnout at the Greenwich School District was historic. We know who benefits from high turnout, so I am pleased for having been engaged. We are breathing sighs of relief for not only dodging bullets, but showing our potential for the future. Also, we go to, let's see, David, who says, I've never seen a larger turnout for a budget or school board vote than this year. The reason I think for sure was there were two young brothers who described themselves as two God-fearing men who would stop the teaching of critical race theory, which they've stopped calling now, and they just call it CRT, which I think is, anyway. The wearing of masks for COVID, if need be again, and other progressive issues. They were very scary dudes who won't, luckily, have the chance to turn back the clock to the 1950s. It is a good day here. We go to Vesta, who says, I am struck by the irony of the similarity between Dr. Oz and L. Frank Baum's character in The Wizard of Oz. They are both lying, shape-shifting snake oil salesmen who govern or admire governing through fear. Dr. Oz peddles quack remedies to vastly enrich his fortune. He echoes Trump's false election claims, not because he is under duress or trying to feed his family. It is all about power to add to his immense wealth. Where are you, Oprah, to condemn the charlatan you foisted on the American public? Your silence speaks volumes. So many people who have a platform take the route of cowards.
Where's Dorothy? We need Dorothy to come back and pull the curtain back and reveal all the dishonesty. And our little dog, Toto, too.
Johnny says, I like Fetterman as well, and I find it refreshing that he dresses casually instead of the standard suit and tie, but it's the substance of his argument that matters the most, and I bet the students would say the same thing. If he didn't have a good stance on the issue...
I'm with Rosemary.
Go ahead, Rosemary.
I have some skepticism about that. I think it's the hoodie and the tattoos.
I bet the students would say the same thing. If he didn't have a good stance on the issues, no one would care about his clothes. This is the first I've heard about John Fetterman, and I like the fact that he does this, writes James, because it helps him stand out and it helps young people like me to relate to him. I personally like I can relate to someone in gym shorts and a hoodie more than someone wearing a suit. I think it's a nice way to be non-traditional and to really show that they want change right off the bat. I wish we had a candidate like that running for office in New York State. So, attention, Lee Zeldin.
Get those gym shorts out.
Go to Dick's and buy a hoodie. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a great panel, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Teresa Bourgeois, and Terry Gibson. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. First news with my favorite guy in a hoodie, Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion.
We just had the most interesting conversation.
It's a little bit of a
We have to sell the outtakes.
A little mini rant around the table. That's good. Welcome, everyone. Thank you. Panel@wamc.org. Don't worry. We save the best stuff for you, the listener.
Listeners at home ranting, too. So
yes,
we're
exactly.
All doing it.
That's right. That's a good point, Teresa. We don't hear what they're saying either.
They can write it to us.
panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Teresa Bourgeois, and Terry Gibson. A couple letters, and we'll move on to other subjects. This is the, I think I read that one. Teresa, remember how Trump said he liked the uneducated? It's those that are educated that are using the uneducated to get power. Everyone likes some sort of power, and unfortunately, some have no morals. Then we got this from Joe, who says, "When
to be clear, I'm not the person who, you know, points to the quote unquote uneducated on this.
I am, but I got your point. In fact, I think I said the same thing. We agree."
Joe says, "When Fred Thompson ran for Senate from Tennessee, he arrived in a nice big car wearing a suit and tie. The crowds were tepid." When they convinced him to ride around in a pickup truck while wearing overalls, the crowds turned on to him and he won. Should note he was also an actor, but
I was going to say
for whatever.
Is this a movie that yet another movie that I don't know, like Star Wars?
He was everywhere. He was the DA on Law and Order.
He would usually play a judge or a president or an evil vice president.
But this is an actor thing.
This is an actor.
Yeah. Yet another.
And he was the senator of Fred Thompson.
Oh, Fred! I know who Fred. Who's yeah. actual senator? Yes, he served when I was working there.
Yeah, so that's who we're talking about. He was saying that he was, but he was also an actor, as you know. Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's all.
I'm just getting caught up on my popular culture. All right.
He was
so
a senator, but he played one on TV, too.
That's right.
I saw him play one in the Senate in real life.
And he's passed, I believe, right?
He passed away? Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
He did.
Okay.
You know, Joe, this thing about appearance that we keep coming back to.
He passed and died. Go ahead. What?
I was just going to say this issue about appearance that we keep speaking about, it's not monolithic. You look at Donald Trump. Donald Trump's uniform was blue suit, white shirt, red tie, always. And of
orange
course,
hue.
He was widely embraced and widely accepted by millions
of
people.
Wait, though, Terry, that still fits what you're saying, too, because the image he was portraying was the businessman, the executive, the guy who would fire people. So that his appearance did match the persona he was projecting.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying exactly, that candidates tend to present themselves in the way that they believe the audience will find them to be the most appealing.
Right.
And that audience is going to be different depending on what office you're running for and where it's located.
Exactly.
So there is no one right uniform that is appropriate when running for office or doing anything else for that matter. It all depends on who your audience is.
I'm so sorry for interrupting. That was brilliant.
So
well, I don't know if I'd go that far, but thank you.
Take the compliment.
I want to move on from politics, but I included this
what?
For no, just for, we won't get that far. Don't worry.
Not North Carolina.
There was the panel yesterday, a House Intelligence Subcommittee summoned military experts to provide the first testimony and half a century about the existence of UFOs. And Dana Milbank wrote a great piece in the in the Washington Post. So Elise Stefanik was a member of this committee and was supposed to keep on. They kept the hearing going and going and going because she had remarks to make. But then she just showed up.
She never
showed up. They were waiting for her to show up, and then she never did. She never arrived.
Is it kind of like the UFOs are waiting?
Well, that's right. And they said lawmakers once finished kept the hearing going because Stefanik, a committee member, was allegedly en route to question the witnesses, but she never showed up. Was it an alien abduction? And if so, where can we send the thank you note? That's the
data mail bag. I love that story. In fact, I pegged it when you sent it, when you flagged it for us to read, Joe, because I think it could be the opening class in this RPI course on media and misinformation. We are a society that does not believe in climate change, even though the overwhelming science supports it. We do not believe in the efficacy of vaccines, even though the empirical proof is that it does keep you from dying. But we are willing to entertain UFOs and the possibility of alien life on Earth, even though there's no evidence that we can point to. So we are so messed up about information and how you present it so that people understand, and how do conspiracy theories begin developing. People watching the hearing yesterday objected when the military said, oh, we don't have any evidence of that. And they walked away saying, see, it's a cover-up. So a new conspiracy is born. It's just a fascinating look on how Americans are thinking these days, or not thinking.
It's a great point. And this will go on. I mean, this will
yep.
Didn't
settle anything.
Yeah. Except for I do think, Rosemary, I do think more and more people are understanding the issues around climate change and accepting the science. There are still people who aren't.
What makes you think that?
The UFOs.
What makes you think that? Seriously, I'm not being
You really
being
don't
flighty.
Think people have come to, I mean, it's taken 40 years, but you don't think people have come to understand that climate change is a problem?
I think some people understand it, but
you don't
none of them are in Congress that I can see. None of them are in places of action. I mean, remember,
well,
it was
not,
Jimmy Carter who put solar panels on the White House. And when he was defeated, Ronald Reagan came in, right? Am I got that right?
Yeah.
Right.
And took them right off. And right, that's exactly where we are right now.
But that was in the 80s. No. That's
yeah, no, no, so, we're not much further ahead.
I think there are members, I mean, we were talking about him at the break, Congressman Tonko. He has been on this issue for 40 years, and I think the country is catching up to people like him or Amory Lovins or, you know, not to name names, there's lots and lots of people. But I do think the country is waking up to and taking action on the climate issue much more. And the science is clear, and certainly not everyone, but, you know, the infrastructure bill has a lot of funding in it
and
for
it isn't
climate
passing.
Issues.
And it is not passing. The Build Back Bill, which with all the climate stuff.
Well, the infrastructure
part.
Oh, the infrastructure. Okay,
the
bipartisan.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I had more than we have. I don't know. It's just so little, so late. I think that there's a tendency in the media to say, oh, it's not hopeless because then people give up. But it looks pretty hopeless.
It's not hopeless. And I do think I do think change is coming. I think that, I mean, this is what how many different iterations we have of a movement toward electric vehicles. But I do think, we have GM and the major companies moving in that direction, creating an infrastructure to move in that direction. I think you have a lot of funding behind, strengthening the grid so that you can take on all the new solar and wind. I do think that there are some fundamental changes that are beginning to happen. Will they happen fast enough? I don't know. But I think there's a much broader awareness now. I remember in the 90s when I first was talking with people about climate change and was getting educated on it, you know, people were thought to be way out there. But I do think, and certainly, you know, you look at somebody again like Congressman Tonko, who has really been pressing on this issue for a long time, but I think I think we're getting there.
Ukraine just undoes all of the goodness. We're so aware that we're waging what is shaping into and horribly could still turn into a global conflict that undoes everything you say. It's moving us back towards nuclear, even though we still don't know what to do with nuclear waste. It is resources that should be going into energy transformation will now go into rebuilding the old systems. It's just, no, we're not getting ahead. And every indication, starting with especially the UN, we're not doing enough. Nope. Awareness.
I have
is
no doubt that we're not
enough.
Doing enough, but I do think there's a. Sorry, Joe.
No, I just love that
we'll take this outside.
I just love the show. I
take
just
started at you fellows, and here we are.
I just want to point out for our audience, it's obvious, but that's my job to help point out the obvious, that we started the show by celebrating floating solar in Cohoes. And Rosemary is basically saying, okay, but once a Republican comes in, they're going to rip those panels right out of the river.
I am.
Okay.
So I think vote. It's important. Pay attention.
Go ahead, Terry.
I just think that it's important to point out, too, that the conflict, the war in the Ukraine now, has just opened the door even wider for oil and gas companies here in the United States pressure congressional members to give them even more freedom than they already had to do more drilling, to produce more oil. And it's hard to see that we're anywhere even remotely close to getting off fossil fuels in the future because the demand for it is continuing to grow even more every day.
Yes.
But you don't think there's a change in the conversation?
This.
I mean, we're in Cohoes, New York. We're putting in floating solar, a working class community. These changes are happening in people's homes and others all over the country. People are shifting to electric cars. You don't think there's any change in the conversation and awareness that there's an urgency about this?
I think there is.
I do think there is a change in conversation awareness, and I think the younger generation is more concerned than previous generations, and that does give me hope. But I think the power that the oil and gas and fossil fuel industry has only grown, and that's an enormous amount of power. And they can literally keep this progress from really moving forward in an effective manner if we don't elect people who are willing to stand up against them and say, no, we're not going to keep drilling.
Well, we certainly have seen them block the
affordable for everyone.
In the past, we've seen cycles of them blocking progress on electric vehicles, for instance. But now it's not just politicians. It's the industry that's saying, it's General Motors that's saying, it's Ford that's saying we're going to move in this direction. And I think, you know, it's industry, it's the financial institutions who are saying,
know, we're not going to bet on that because that's yesterday's news. It's I know. Well, in any case, I'm talking.
Well, I think the one thing we have to remember on this panel is it's never all or nothing.
Right.
I mean, you know, obviously there are some people pulling in one direction, others pulling in another. You know, I think I see some real signs of progress here. I think I agree with you.
I mean,
I think Teresa's point on the electric car industry is a valid one. That you do see these traditional industries that relied on producing fossil fuel cars moving in the direction of electric cars, right. But they're just not doing it fast enough. They're not doing it with as much enthusiasm as they need to be doing it because they still see that their main line of profit is going to require things that run on gas.
Well, it depends on what. Sorry, Jeff.
No, I was just going to ask a question about. But everything changes if in 2 years Trump or a Trump-like Republican wins the White House and all of the work that was, some of the work that was undone that was initiated by the Trump administration is reversed again, right? And then,
right.
And then whatever benefit, whatever was going to benefit those companies won't anymore.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
They can turn on
it. It doesn't have to be Donald Trump that gets elected. Just about any Republican that gets elected.
Well, that's what I said, a Trump-like Republican.
Turning back climate change doesn't even require just unity in the United States, which seems impossible.
Yeah, it's a world.
It requires global unity, which is even more difficult to put together. We've never accomplished. What joint project has the whole world ever worked on?
But when I see the World Economic Forum, which I follow,
happiness,
which is very conservative, right? The conservative business people, and they are really focused on the circular economy, the full life cycle cost of drilling and these other things. And I guess when I see that they are part of leading a global conversation, I say things have changed dramatically. And I think we have a long way to go, but we'll see if a change in administration to Republican, does that really then change the direction that Ford is going in? Does that change the direction that GM is going in? Does that stop all the wind energy projects and switch to drilling? I mean, I do think, you know, people are okay with paying $5 for a cup of Starbucks coffee, but they don't want to pay $5 for a gallon of gas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I'm not promoting $5 for a gallon of gas, but I think if you took the full life cycle cost of a gallon of gas, it would be far more than $5. And if you went to Europe, right. And then, but also you have much more public transportation. It's a more common thing.
Sure.
People, you know, you don't have sprawl that we have. People make adjustments in any case.
Okay, I'll admit it. I was watching MSNBC yesterday afternoon, and they broke in, and I thought Nicole Wallace was having heart palpitations. I think they were going to have to hook her up to a machine because I thought she was going to lose it because the Justice Department has asked the House committee investigating the January 6th attack for transcripts of interviews it is conducting behind closed doors, including some with associates of former President Donald Trump, according to people with knowledge of the situation. I thought for a moment they were taking a former President Trump away in handcuffs in the way that she was salivating. But as I read the article from the Times, it doesn't seem quite as exciting. The move is further evidence of the wide-ranging nature of the department's criminal inquiry into the events leading up to the assault on the Capitol and the role played by Mr. Trump and his allies as they sought to keep him in office after the defeat in the 2020 election. The House committee, which has no power to pursue criminal charges, has interviewed more than 1,000 people so far. The transcripts could be used by the Justice Department as evidence in potential criminal cases to pursue new leads or as a baseline for new interviews conducted by federal law enforcement officials. So, Alan, we have been talking a lot in this program over the last several weeks and months about a lack of action taken by Merrick Garland. So here we go. What do you make of it?
Why is my finger down my throat? The answer is that the Justice Department has been turtle-like slow in making any of this stuff happen, and I'm sure they're reacting on some level to the accusations that they're not doing enough and they're not doing it fast enough. But it is something that I'm quite worried about because I think the evidence is there and it's not being followed.
I don't know the procedure. I don't know if we have any lawyers here, asking for the transcripts, I mean, have they not been paying attention reading the newspaper? Isn't this out? Is this like, it's like, oh, we heard something about you guys are doing something. Can you give us some paperwork?
Can I see the transcript of that tweet?
What does that, or is it, or we've followed everything, now we need to really all nail it down. I don't really know.
Well, it's very political in my mind. In other words, they're getting a lot of criticism for not having done this, for not having followed up, mm-hmm. so they make a little tweak-like move to say we need to see this, as you're so right, Rosemary, as if they didn't have that information already.
Mm-hmm. Asked about the Justice Department's request after this article was published, the article that broke the story in the New York Times, Benny Thompson drew a distinction between handing over the committee's materials and allowing certain documents to be reviewed. He suggested that the panel had invested significant time and effort in conducting so many interviews and was reluctant to simply turn them over.
Oh, give us a break.
Oh, my gosh.
That's terrible.
That's the whole, oh, boy. I don't understand how this all works. I want to read more on the procedure. How does the committee's work get turned over to the Justice Department? How are they connected? How does it work?
The department's investigation has been operating on a separate track from the committee's work. Generally, investigators working on the two inquiries have not been sharing information, except for at times communicating to ensure that a witness is not scheduled to appear before different investigators at the same time. So, in other words, you don't make your cardiology appointment when you make your urology appointment.
Well, maybe.
Are you?
Well, that's right. I mean, I guess you could do them at the same time, but it would be, I don't know. A little bit of juggling, as it were. A spokesman for the Justice Department declined to comment.
Well, it's ridiculous. I mean, the idea that you've got a Democratic Congress, you've got a Democratic Justice Department, that they can't even find the wherewithal to share this information, which we pretty well know anyway, is really just such an insight into the way that Washington works.
Teresa, you know how Washington works. You worked there for decades. What do you think?
Well, when I read that the prosecutors, I'm quoting here from the story, have been asking for records about people who organized or spoke at several pro-Trump rallies after the 2020 election, as well as anyone who provided security at those events and others who are deemed, quote-unquote, VIP attendees, I'm hoping that they're asking for these records because they have already pursued this line themselves, mm-hmm. and they want to compare what was said to the committee and what was said to them. Uh-huh. But we don't know that because we shouldn't know that, because what they do is typically appropriately done in secret. We saw what happens when it wasn't with Hillary Clinton, right? Mm-hmm. When they decided to do it, you know, talk about it in public. But
God help us if they share with the public.
Like, mm-hmm. I can only hope that they're asking for this not because they haven't done the groundwork themselves, but because they want to see the comparison. But I have no knowledge at all. And if, in fact, it's because they're seeing it for the first time, that's disturbing because, you know, they have proceeded against 800 or more people who attended. But it's not just the people who attended. I mean, it's been real clear for a long time. It's the organizers. And how far up the power chain does that go? Does it go right into the White House? Does it go into the halls of Congress? We need to know that, because this is a fundamental attack on our democracy, on
Carol,
our country.
One of the worst things we've ever seen.
And we need to know and have an understanding. Even if so many other people, well, I'm past that, let's move on. You shouldn't get past an attack on
democracy.
Your seat of government.
Yeah. Well, I know this is naive, but, and I echo, I guess, what you say, Teresa, is that on January 7th and January 8th and January 9th, when we were talking about this on this program, we were saying, okay, well, who funded this? Who got the people there? Where were the buses coming from? Where was the money?
Mm-hmm.
And so here we are in May of 2022. We have some of those answers, but we're not doing anything about it seems.
And we have people running for Congress. We have people running for Senate. We have people running for governor.
Who attended that event.
Or supported, or who are not denouncing an attack on our Capitol, where 150-plus police officers were injured, 4 have died, a person was killed. It was a terrible attack on our seat of government. And we have people running for Congress and Senate and governor who are not only not denouncing it, in some cases embracing it. And that's a deep problem in our country.
I'm gonna turn on my mic. I'm going to hold you there, and we will continue for our last go-round. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll finish up right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Teresa Bourgeois, and Terry Gibson. Terry, you have anything you want to add? I'll assume
no. Here I am. It just struck me as interesting that the attorney, one of the assistant attorneys who seems to be heading up this from the Justice Department, is named Mr. Polite.
Yeah.
I think we're in trouble already.
Very Dickensian.
Yeah, one of the best things in the world to do is to grab your big fat telephone book, if there is still one in your home, and look up names that you know are really quite troubling in terms of our modern language. That's where I'm going to stop.
Yes. Okay.
Our farmer was named Mr. Plant. We had a farmer named Mr. Plant, and he would bring vegetables to our neighborhood every Saturday.
There is no word.
I'm trying to change the conversation.
Not in there.
I had a colleague in the newspaper was named Betsy News.
Okay, forget it.
Anyway, let's move on.
I was trying to save you from yourself, Alan.
So yeah. Just move on.
I had a, actually.
Move on, Alan.
Louis Fallick was the kid.
Oh, dear. Hello, check, please.
Alan, I was.
My mother
to
always
you.
Used to tell me about right here in Cohoes, Teresa. There was in the old days, there was an optometrist whose name was Seymour Rotner.
Okay.
That's a great name.
Seymour
Rotner, and he was an optometrist.
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
That's great.
All right, let's go to...
I have my story.
Okay,
I'm sorry,
Terry.
I cut my finger once and had to have it stitched up by a person named Dr. Payne.
How many letters are we going to get? I want to
hear
all of them.
And there we go.
I want to hear all of them.
All right, a couple letters, and then we'll get on to other issues here. A number of you seem to assume, writes Tom, that support of certain candidates is based solely on different levels of education
and not other factors
such as economic standing. Democrats, including the Squad and the Progressive Congressional Caucus, have just greenlit $40 billion for a war that won't benefit Americans and will only prolong the suffering of Ukrainians and enrich defense contractors. I don't think...
It's a gross simplification of what we said, and may I point out that support of war is, as it always has been in America, very bipartisan.
I don't think that's just professional, congressional,
yeah.
Yes. Okay, we go to Linda. My mom, God rest her soul, said we should dump everything in volcanoes. All right.
Like what?
What to do with the
politicians?
Waste. I think it is the question of what to do with the waste. When we were talking about nuclear waste, dropping it into a volcano.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
Wow.
So I've been reading about what to do with e-waste. Anyway, that's boring.
I'm sorry, say again?
E-waste.
What to do with all of your electronics.
Yeah.
They need to...
That's a good question, yeah.
But you
I have three computers I want to get rid of.
Teresa, I feel like we have to counsel you on...
Not talking about boring things?
Well, no. To talk about them, but don't label them as, I'm about to talk about this thing, and by the way, it's boring.
E-waste
doesn't sound boring.
Do you know that you could mine it? So right now it's difficult as we expand our green economy.
Right.
You need certain minerals and such, and so some people are starting to figure out: can you, rather than put all of this stuff in the, landfill, can you mine some of the materials that are made in it? So anyway, back to what you were saying, Joe. Go with it.
All right, electric. This one's on electric cars. Shannon says we need to acknowledge that electric cars are not a sustainable solution at this time. Tesla batteries need to be replaced every 5 years and cost $50,000. That is not possible for the vast majority of Americans. To build one Tesla battery requires two football fields worth of earth to be mined. Nearly 100% of the resources to build those batteries are not available in the U.S. or will not be allowed to mine due to our own environmental laws. As of right now, electric cars are a luxury good, cost prohibitive to most, directly affected by international supply chain issues, and destroy our earth through the very invasive mining practices. We need to invest more money in this technology.
Well, if only I talked about e-waste after that letter instead of before, because that's exactly. And Priuses, I mean, there are people who use Priuses.
I have one.
Yeah.
But who can afford them? Who can afford them? They're not affordable for the average American.
A Prius?
I don't think
I think the Prius, but I mean, the Teslas aren't. I would agree with you. I think Priuses are fairly.
If you had to pay the full life cycle cost?
I mean, quite frankly, any car right now isn't affordable.
Right.
But Brett says, have you seen the redistricting maps that put Saratoga Springs into District 21? Do you think this could give Democrats a chance of getting Stefanik out of office?
No.
Probably not.
That was fast.
Oh, my goodness.
All right.
Our hero, Congressman Tonko.
Here is
I am really upset about that.
Here is a gift to you, Teresa Bourgeois, for the fine work you have done this morning. This letter comes in from Jennifer. I'm curious, is there any information regarding floating solar panels if they break? Is there a concern for water contamination?
Floating solar is not common in the U.S. It's just an emerging technology, but it is very common in Europe and in Asia, and this has been looked at quite a bit. And based on the research that we found, there is not a concern. It's not something to worry about, particularly if you use bifacial. Okay, that's getting down into the weeds, but certain types of panels. But this has been looked at. They are used in cold weather, warm weather. And one of the things that we're focused on is ours is a human-made water reservoir. So people say, well, will it hurt the ecosystem? Well, it's not. These reservoirs are not natural ecosystems. So it's not disrupting a natural ecosystem, like if you're using farmland or whatever. And in fact, there's some benefits to it, because there's a lot of issues with algae in a water reservoir, so it naturally reduces algae growth. So you can use fewer chemicals in the water to kill the algae, because it will naturally kill the algae. And also, not as big a deal for here, but certainly in warmer climates, southern places like California, whatever, there's a big issue with evaporation, loss of water through evaporation, and it naturally reduces water evaporation.
And so there. So
no, right. No. It's a very important question that we really take seriously, and we've talked to a lot of people about, because it's a very natural concern to ask that, hey, you're going to drink this water. Is this okay? And we've really looked into that, asked experts, because we're not experts ourselves. So glad to get the question.
All right. We have about...
So good, isn't she?
She's excellent.
We love Teresa. 6 minutes to go. I'm going to throw this one out, and it is President Biden visiting Buffalo yesterday, calling on Americans to, quote, take on the haters and reject the lie of racial replacement that animated a white man to gun down black shoppers in the latest eruption of violence targeting people of color in the United States, declaring that, quote, white supremacy is a poison coursing through America. Mr. Biden flew to Buffalo in western New York, not just to mourn the 10 people killed in Saturday's shooting rampage, but to confront ideology rooted in fear and racism and accuse conservative political and media figures of exploiting it. What happened here is simple and straightforward. Terrorism, domestic terrorism, Mr. Biden told a bereaved crowd gathered in a community center. Violence inflicted in the service of hate and the vicious thirst for power that defines one group of people being inherently inferior to any other group, a hate that through the media and politics, the internet, has radicalized angry, alienated, lost, and isolated individuals into falsely believing that they will be replaced. I will just throw this out as fodder for discussion. I thought the president did an amazing job yesterday in speaking on this issue, and I'm curious as to what you all make of it. And I mean, there's one thing, obviously, there's a difference between giving a really good speech and making the needle move in any meaningful way.
I thought he did a good job as well. I'm concerned that I don't have evidence to really support this, but at least in my observation, it doesn't seem to be getting a lot of press coverage. His speech didn't get a lot of press coverage, and I'm not really convinced that the average voter in swing states is really listening and paying attention. And I think that his ability to really affect change in a positive way is really limited because of the political division that we have in this country right now.
Yeah, I think this is one of those issues like the economy that the president gets blame or praise, but really has very little control. Let me remind you that, unfortunately, President Obama, who is one of the great orators of our time, had many occasions to give these kinds of speeches and make these appearances, mm-hmm. most notably Sandy Hook. He did an incredible job, as I think Biden did a very, very good job yesterday, Jill Biden with him. Doesn't make any difference until there's gun regulation, until there's treatment and recognition of the connections between mental health illness and these events, until there's better security, until all the things that we talk about endlessly on this program, a sympathetic appearance by a president at a scene of tragedy makes no difference.
And yet, Rosemary, don't you agree that we're better off that the president of the United States said it and that there will be people who will listen to it? Not all, you know, obviously, but it's an important thing that a president doesn't let that kind of opportunity go by.
As opposed to Trump, who had his wife send out a note saying, "Our prayers and thoughts are with you." Yeah, definitely.
It's important. It's important that the president said that. But we're in a situation where it's highly likely that Republicans are going to take over the House of Representatives in the next election. And if you look at any Republican that is running for a seat in Congress this upcoming election, you will see every single one of them on their websites promotes standing up for the Second Amendment, which means that they are not going to be interested in doing anything about controlling guns and making guns illegal. So the only way that we can fix this is for people to get serious about electing people that are going to be committed to making guns a top priority and taking them off the streets and making them illegal at a federal level. And that's what we need to happen.
His term of domestic terrorism, as this article points out, represented a stark contrast to President Trump, whose White House was accused by Homeland Security analysts of discouraging officials from even saying the words. How important is it to say those words, that it is domestic terrorism?
I think it's essential to say it's domestic terrorism, but I also think that, Alan, I agree with you. I think it's so important that the president, you know, it used to be that people would say that this was coming from the deep, dark corners of our country where, but now it's being fomented not in the deep, dark depths of the, you know, internet, the interweb or whatever you call it, but it's on Fox News. And this is not just Fox News, but it's really in the mainstream media. And this fomenting of hate, this building on people's fears, stoking people's fears as a way to gain power, has consequences. And we need to have a conversation about the consequences this stoking of hate has. And we need to have a conversation about the kinds of supports people need, but also... And I thought it was interesting, the president was real clear that he doesn't think there's going to be gun legislation. He mm-hmm. doesn't think there's anything more he can do mm-hmm. administratively. I listened on Sunday when Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts was interviewed on CNN State of the Union. And so Dana Bash asked him about guns, and he kept diverting, saying, "I'm talking about prevention. My focus is on prevention." And why she didn't say, "Well, reducing the availability of guns is one of the most important things you could do for prevention," but she let it go. I mean, there are so many more guns in this country. There are a record number of guns in this country. And I'm not talking about taking guns away from hunters, but it's just a very dangerous combination, and it's not just for the president. We all have to do something about this national conversation that's fomenting hate, about the easy availability of guns, and until we do that, it's electing people, but it's more than that. It's how we're interacting with people, mm-hmm. what we fund. what we support. We support PayPal with Peter Thiel, who supports Tucker Carlson, who supports these theories. Or maybe we don't put more money in Peter Thiel's pockets, right? I don't know.
All right. We're going to have to end there, unfortunately, but I thank you all for being with us. Alan, good to have you. Thank you very much.
Great to be here, Joe.
Rosemary Armeo, thank you.
Thank you. Love being here.
Teresa Bourgeois, always wonderful to have you on our program. I look forward to seeing you next week. And Terry Gibson, same to you. Be well.
Thank you. I'll be there with my sport coat on next time.
I want you in a hoodie and shorts with some ink. Even if that tag got
it. Wear that.
With those tags. Yeah. You know, like, fake ink.
We'll be back right after this.